the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, investigations are underway over 400,000 oysters that have been stolen from Mid-North Coast Farm. We'll hear more about that shortly. And the stoush over carbon credits in the Koala National Park. It's gaining momentum with the Greens and the National Party, both opposed due to carbon storage and forestry issues. But former Treasury Secretary Ken Henry says we need to stop bickering and get on with it.
Instead, what we have to do and what the Australian policy framework tries to do is to give those carbon polluters an incentive to reduce their emissions. Now, when they buy carbon credits, this is not free. These carbon credits are going to get increasingly expensive. It's a cost that emitters are going to have to bear, and that cost, that increasing cost, provides an incentive, a strong incentive, increasing over time, for them to cut their emissions.
We'll hear more about that story shortly. We'll also look at Russian conflict timber as well, and where it's coming from, how it's getting into the country. It's been tracked now. We'll hear more about that shortly. But first to bird flu. One of Australia's largest chicken processors, Ingham's Group, has warned retail chicken prices are likely to rise even if they manage to avoid a big bird flu outbreak. Ingham's is one of the two companies, along with Baiada, which supplies 70% of broiler chickens in Australia, which end up on dinner plates and in fast food. And last week, Ingham delivered its full year financial results, announcing a slump in annual profit on the back of soaring costs with no end to the Middle East conflict. And we might, they're warning, we might end up paying more for chickens in the next 12 months. With some of the details, here's Emma Field.
Australian appetite for chicken has never been stronger. It's the most popular meat, and on average, every week, Australians eat just over 1 kilo of poultry. And why are we eating more chicken? Well, according to research done by the chicken industry, it's because it's cheaper than any other type of meat and easy to prepare. Ingham's provide 40% of all the chicken we eat, but they have not been immune to cost blowouts. And as Chief Executive Officer of Ingham's Group, Edward Alexander, told an investor meeting, they are also worried about bird flu.
This is a real and a significant risk for the poultry industry. We take this risk extremely seriously and we are prepared for it. One of Ingham's fundamental strengths is the design of our network. We operate across multiple geographically separated regions with distinct clusters spanning feed mills, farming, hatcheries, processing facilities and distribution infrastructure. That means an outbreak in one location does not automatically translate into disruption across our broad network. We have the ability to isolate affected areas, protect other parts of the network, and redirect production and supply. We've also invested considerable effort in prevention, surveillance, scenario planning, and response protocols. Senior management have spent time in Europe understanding learnings from their experience. We can't fully eliminate the risk, but we can control how well prepared we are for it.
Across Europe, over 280 million birds have been culled as a result of the bird flu virus since 2021. In the US, 16 million broiler birds alone had to be culled, along with about 184 million other commercial birds, including egg-laying chickens. But Ingham says broiler chicken production is generally more protected from bird flu than egg production. And so far, fears of an outbreak hasn't affected the appetite for chicken.
We're not seeing any impact on demand at the moment. It's been well communicated that there's no food safety issue pertaining to bird flu, and we're not seeing that through any of our channels. You certainly see a greater impact across the egg producers, and I'd say, you know, one is simply the age of the birds. An older bird is slightly more susceptible to catching avian flu, and more generally speaking, there's a lower sort of biosecurity controls that can be in place across that industry. But yeah, we've certainly observed that across Europe as well.
The CEO was pressed on which Ingham's production region is the biggest and hence where an outbreak would have the biggest effect on chicken supply.
Our biggest sites are in Queensland and South Australia. Our next biggest site's Victoria, and then WA and Tasmania are smaller sites. The big ones are Queensland and South Australia. They're our two largest facilities. Assume bird flu does hit, it'll hit obviously one of our farms. So within a 2 kilometre radius, it's problematic. But then as long as you sort of depopulate within that zone, you know, that's the kind of impacted portion of the population. So I kind of think about it as three layers. You go the geographic separation, then you go separation across farms, which again, I think we've designed our farms and our spreading of farms with biosecurity in mind. And then thirdly, it goes back to obviously the capability, expertise, and ability of the business to respond.
So bird flu aside, the financial news Ingham delivered wasn't great. The company reported a 61.5% slump in net profit to $31 million for the year to June 30. The additional $13 million in costs linked to the Middle East conflict dampened the bottom line as a result.
Our two best months last year were February and March, ultimately, before the Middle East crisis hit.
Ingham's Group CEO, Edward Alexander there. And what about the rest of the industry and chicken processors? Are they worried about bird flu or rising costs? And will these costs be passed on to growers? Well, it's hard to know. The ABC contacted Baida, Hazeldine and Cordina, along with the Australian Chicken Meat Federation and Australian Chicken Growers Council. We either didn't hear back or they referred us to the Federal Department of Agriculture. In a statement, DAF says they are holding regular industry briefings to ensure the sector is up to date about the current detection of bird flu in wildlife, so businesses can make informed decisions on the risk of disease incursions on their premises, the DAF statement said.
Emma Field reporting there, and just a reminder, if you do see any sick or dead birds, you can ring the hotline. They've had thousands of calls here in New South Wales, about 15 or 16 cases I think so far, but thousands of cases in South Australia as we know. The number, the bird flu hotline number, is 1-800-675-888, 1-800-675-888.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
When the New South Wales government announced the creation of the Great Koala National Park, it hinged on a proposal to fund it with creating hundreds of millions of dollars in carbon credits. This required the federal government's approval, which will be debated in the Senate next month, with the Greens potentially opposing it. Former Treasury boss Ken Henry chairs the Australian Climate and Biodiversity Foundation. He told Sally Sarah on Radio National, it's vital the proposal is approved to protect the forests from logging and fund national parks.
The issue here is whether the community thinks it's a good idea or not to have Australia's biggest carbon polluters pay to have our native forests protected and restored for 100 years. That's what's at stake here.
Critics, some argue that carbon credits are a smokescreen for failing to do the real work of decarbonisation. Why are you so convinced that corporate interests can also, if it's done right, be in the interests of the environment here?
Well, corporate interests respond to market incentives. That's what they respond to. I don't know how on earth the critics of this method think they're going to kill off the fossil fuel industry. They don't have a plan to kill off the fossil fuel industry. It's just a dream. They imagine in the middle of the night that somehow or another they'll wake up and the fossil fuel industry globally will be dead, and that will help to bring carbon emissions under control. It's merely a pipe dream. Nobody has a plan to do that. Instead, what we have to do and what the Australian policy framework tries to do is to give those carbon polluters an incentive to reduce their emissions. Now, when they buy carbon credits, this is not free. K's carbon credits are going to get increasingly expensive. It's a cost that emitters are going to have to bear, and that cost, that increase in cost, provides an incentive, a strong incentive, increasing over time, for them to cut their emissions. But at the same time, what it does is it provides the revenue to do amazing things that nobody, including the Greens, have ever been able to dream of, which is to get enough money together to fund the restoration of Australia's native forests for 100 years. That is what the carbon method in front of the Senate requires, 100 years protection.
Why do you see this upcoming vote as so politically consequential?
Well, it's policy consequential and it's driven by politics. What is being discussed here is not really the merits of the policy. As soon as the government announced that its independent scientific committee had given the tick to this carbon after 18 months of deliberation and consultation with all of the experts around the country. As soon as that was announced, the National Party said, oh, yeah, we're going to oppose it. Why? Well, ostensibly, because they think the logging should continue. That's what they say. Logging is great. Logging is fantastic. Nothing wrong with logging. Let's continue to hack into the bush, tear the trees down, degrade the quality of the natural environment, because you know what? There's something about logging that means that it should stand above all of those other considerations. It's more important than the quality of the natural environment. I'm here in the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales today, and I'll be talking to community leaders here about the importance of them focusing on the sources of future prosperity. And the sources of future prosperity in the Northern region, Northern Rivers region of New South Wales, do not rest on continued logging. On the other hand, you've got some in the Greens movement who are saying, well, the forests are so spiritually important that we shouldn't let money anywhere near them. There's the problem.
Ken Henry is the chair of the Australian Climate and Biodiversity Foundation. Now, just to clarify, the Greens oppose the Great Koala National Park and the carbon credit system. They're saying it's not additional carbon storage. They say credits must result from actions that lower emissions beyond what's already planned, meaning that the park fails an additionality test. They also argue that the pre-promised park for offsets lets heavy emitters buy credits without driving actual new abatement. They argue the national park should be protected for their intrinsic national value rather than financial market transactions or as permitted for polluters. The National Party and regional timber communities, they're against the move. They argue that locking up native forests for carbon credits shuts down local mills, destroys regional jobs and damages related small businesses. The Nationals also claim that the improved native forest management crediting method provides no real emissions reduction and acts as an indirect government subsidy. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 17 minutes past 12. While the Russian conflict timber, it's continuing to find its way into the Australian building sector despite tariffs and sanctions. According to a Senate report, the timber industry says it will now pursue an application to the Anti-Dumping Commission to stop Russian timber coming in through third-party countries. Engineered wood and products like LVL imports are up 63% on last year, and they mostly come from China. Richard Hyatt is the acting CEO of the Australian Forest Products Association and says that this is hurting the Australian industry.
The Russian timber is a really significant issue for Australian manufacturers. When the war in Ukraine started a few years ago, the government introduced tariffs of Russia, but overnight the imports from Russia shut down and increases in imports from neighbouring countries using Russian fibre increased overnight. So we've got timber coming from China, and we know it's been tested by Source Certain. So we know it's Russian. There's Russian timber coming in, larch, which is not grown in China, coming to Australia. And so we know there is a very significant amount coming in. We estimate up to 100,000 cubic metres, or could contribute to over 15,000 homes in Australia.
Some MPs on the committee have urged you to take the case to the Anti-Dumping Commission. Will you be doing that?
Yes, we're certainly working with the Anti-Dumping Commission on progressing an application, and it's looking like there is a positive outcome in that space, but the positive outcomes mean that our industries are facing material harm. But unfortunately, it does take, you know, time, 12 to 18 months potentially. So in the short term, I think it's important that Australians talk to their builders, ask them where their timber's coming from, and if it's the only way they can guarantee it's not coming from Russia is to get Australian timber. I know building is expensive and people want to look at cheaper options, but I also know Australians don't want to fund the war in Ukraine, and they don't want Australian businesses going out of business because of shady operations using Russian conflict timber.
Labor Senator Raf Ciccone is deputy chair of the committee in charge of the Senate inquiry and says the industry should take the case to the Anti-Dumping Commission.
What I've encouraged the forest products industry to do is to apply through the Anti-Dumping Commission and investigate Russian origin laminated veneer lumber and other engineered wood products that flood in our market. We know that the current arrangements are working, but what we need to do is use existing mechanisms like the Anti-Dumping Commission. We know that laminated veneer lumber imports are up by around 63% in a year in Australia, and many timber workers and manufacturers deserve a fair go because ultimately we'll be impacting local jobs in many regional communities across Australia, whether it be in my home state, Victoria, in the Green Triangle, or in New South Wales in the snowy region. It's important that we protect local jobs, local manufacturing, and the integrity of these supply chains.
Do you think that there's much prospect of a win at the Anti-Dumping Commission and whether that would even influence a country like Russia?
Well, I think ultimately we've got to use the mechanisms that are at our disposal. And, you know, we are all members of the international community. We've signed up to the World Trade Organization and, you know, we have a right to put forward through various arrangements, these anti-dumping commission processes in place. It's important that we do put Russia in the spotlight. And if we are not going to do it, others won't. And I think it's important that Australia leads. And that's why I've called very strongly on the industry to put forward the dumping case. And I think the Australian government and others will be watching very carefully. I know what we have is a 35% tariff on Russian timber since 2022. And as I said earlier, you know, the government, the Australian government has imposed financial sanctions and travel bans on many individuals and entities connected to the Russian Federation. But we also importantly don't want towns where timber and forestry is such an important industry. We've got many communities in New South Wales and many in Victoria that are losing out by having imported Russian origin LVL undercutting locally produced manufactured wood products. And I know we had a lot of solid evidence come to the committee from the industry, which demonstrated that the $6 billion timber manufacturing industry, which supports 80,000 direct jobs and 100,000 indirect jobs, could be impacted if these Russian timber get imported.
Raf Ciccone is a Labor senator. He was ending that report from Josh Becker. You're listening to The Country Hour, 22 minutes past 12. Well, let's stay with forests because the planned feral horse culling operations in a North Coast National Park, they've been put on pause after a Brumby advocate took the state's Environment Department to court earlier this week. Brumby advocate Carmen Jackson filed an urgent injunction in the Land and Environment Court about 1 a.m. on Monday to stop a four-day aerial cull, which was due to start in the Urungia National Park later that morning. National Parks and Wildlife has confirmed all trappings, aerial and land culls planned for this week have been halted until the matter is heard again in the Land and Environment Court on September the 9th. Ms. Jackson told Marina Trajkovic why she filed the urgent stop application.
I believe that all animals have a right to be on country. Just how do we signify that a Brumby is less significant than a native animal on country, considering that they've been here for 200 years? I've been doing in-depth research that Brumbies are actually good for the environment and they're helping the environment, particularly the Corbury frog. I've just researched and done a paper to Springer how the Corbury frog actually uses the Brumby poo as its particular habitat in and can hide also in the Brumby poo. And I've also launched that as a official academic paper. Also, in regards to that, Brumby poo is an ecosystem in itself. So to say that they need to be removed from country as an invasive species is false. And I'm also very logical in regards to human beings create more damage than any other animal within the national park.
And talking about non-lethal alternatives that you've been calling for. What do you see as a solution in terms of, you know, for those sort of environmental protection measures, removing them from the national parks? What would you like to see happen?
I think they should be left alone. I really do believe they should be left to be wild and free on country, particularly when there is no evidence to prove that all the other cases on the other side, which I don't agree with at all, that they are causing damage. There is no damage there. I can tell you that, Marina. There is no damage.
And do you support the rehoming of the horses, for example, or the like trapping them and then putting them to the sanctuaries?
No, I don't, sweetheart. Not at all. I don't believe our Brumbies should be trapped and particularly rehomed, particularly being sold. I see that as trophy hunting, particularly when you've got rehomers there pinpointing particular stallions and going out and getting them trapped.
As Brumby advocate Carmen Jackson speaking about her application in the Land and Environment Court to stop a planned Brumby cull in the Yuragir National Park. Charles Sturt University College Professor David Watson spoke about his views on this injunction.
Coming up with some sort of legal pretext to say, you know, they don't have the statutory right or something. This is just rangers going about their business, controlling a feral animal in a national park. There's precedence for this in every national park across the state. So I think what's been decided for this particular case is, sure, let's just take 2 weeks. Let's make sure all the ducks are lined up. Let's make sure all the policies and legal permissions are indeed in place, and then let's get on with the task of minimising the impacts of ferals.
What's your response to arguments? There seem to be very different public perceptions of feral pigs, for example, compared to the Brumbies, and people saying, you know, they have this cultural and heritage significance for Australia. There seems to be a lot more, you know, emotion, dare I say, involved when it comes to the horses. What's your sort of, you know, response to those kinds of arguments?
Yeah, I get it. I mean, I'm a horse owner. I'm not a pig owner. I love horses. They are special animals, and humans have had a connection with horses for a very long time. For a long time, they were a friend. They were a beast of burden. They were a means of moving around. So I do get it, and I do see that people hold horses to a different level when it comes to animal welfare, when it comes to humanitarian type issues. But from an ecological point of view, that goes out the window. I put them in exactly the same basket as foxes, as deer, as pigs that you mentioned. They're not from here. They actively diminish habitat value for all the other critters, all the other plants that are found nowhere else on Earth. Fragile coastal ecosystems in northern New South Wales. We need to look after them because a whole lot of stuff that lives there lives nowhere else. They're a big animal. They eat a lot. And they hang around in herds, and they've got very hard hooves. They chop up country, and in fragile coastal systems where you've got very shallow soils, you've got dune systems, Brumbies just wreck the joint, as simple as that.
Charles Sturt University Ecology Professor David Watson speaking there to Marina Charkovich. Now, we've got some texts on the bird. We're talking about bird flu and the concerns about the price of poultry and eggs rising as a result of bird flu, even if there isn't an incursion in the farming systems. That was from, we heard from Ingham's, their profits are down as well. Dave in Condobolin has said, He wants to know about this red fox that was being tested for bird flu after being found sick, and asking whether there's any follow-up on that. We don't know a lot about that case, Dave. What we do know is a red fox was found in suburban Adelaide. It is suspected that it has been infected with the H5 bird flu. They're not certain, though. The department, South Australia's Department of Primary Industries, says that. Now, it was found in the Adelaide suburb of Osborne, which is... It's in the suburbs, well in the suburbs there. We do see foxes around Sydney as well, of course, and out in the bush. But so they are in the suburbs. But they're reminding us that there have been 300 infection events that have been recorded across the country since the first cases were detected in June. But that involves several thousands of birds as well, and a couple of mammals too. So that's the latest. But those they're still waiting for the results. results to confirm that the red fox actually did have H5 bird flu. It's coming up to 29 minutes past 12.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Shortly we'll have news headlines and the weather details, but before we do that, investigations are underway after 400,000 oysters were stolen from a mid-north coast farm. Police say 320 aquaculture oyster bags containing the juvenile Sydney Rock oysters were stolen from the leases yesterday morning at Scotts Creek near Oxley Island. Owner of Latitude 31 Oysters, Ryan Freeman, says he's now facing up to $350,000 in losses, and it's left him reeling ahead of Christmas. He told Nikita Jager how he first discovered the theft.
We just went out there to do a routine check on them and just pick some up and go through and grade and send them out, getting ready for sale later in the year at Chrissy. And just as we approached the lease, we noticed that there was a heap of like floating gear, our tumblers missing. And just upon closer inspection, we noticed that some bags had been taken, but also all the bags had been emptied along the lines.
So how many oysters would they have taken?
Oh, we're still going through now and picking up empty bags out there. So we've done a few boatloads already, but we're probably estimating around 300,000 to 350,000 oysters. So it's going to have a massive impact. And
Oh my goodness.
The impact's going to come because we're only still recovering from the recent floods that happened last year. And a lot of this, like, stock that's been stolen was help from the government with their government, like the relief grant, to help restock after we lost them in the floods.
Yep.
So we're sort of back to square one again.
Jeez. And how long does it take to get them to that point, and how much does that set you back economically?
Apart from all the work we've already put in and whatnot, we're probably 350,000, 400,000 out of pocket, if you include labour, the equipment that's been stolen and the livestock.
Have you heard of this happening in the area before, or any other oyster growers or oyster businesses?
Yeah, I have heard of theft, not for a very, very long time up this way, but definitely not of this scale. I've only been oyster farming for about 6 years now, and this is probably the biggest one I've ever heard of.
If they can't find or, recover the oysters, how will you move on, and how will you, get back from this? And it's such a setback.
But it's going to be a massive impact, especially coming up to Christmas. Like, we haven't really got much time before Christmas to now try and, go through and figure out to find more stock, especially mature stock, because it takes us 3 years to 4 years to grow an oyster, a Sydney Rock oyster, that is, yeah.
And they were all Sydney Rock stolen, though?
Yes, yeah, all Sydney Rock oysters, yeah.
And how many would you sell come Christmas? Like, would they be all ready to go?
I'd say that probably 80% of them would have been ready for market by Christmas. That's why, obviously, the thieves have targeted those. I understand everyone's doing it tough, like farmers, everyone, like not just us, it's cattle farmers, everyone after the recent flooding and on the mid-coast, plus the fires and just everything that's happened over the last few years. But I don't believe stealing and taking from someone else is gonna help the cause. All you've done is put someone else out.
That's owner of Latitude 31 Oysters, Ryan Freeman, speaking there about that theft, massive theft of oysters, 400,000 oysters stolen. He was talking there to Nikita Jager. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 27 minutes to one. Time for some news headlines with Adam Storey. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. The federal government has confirmed that 34 Australians are among the missing following the landslide and flash flood that struck the Himalayan border region. At least 150 people are confirmed dead at this stage in Nepal and three in Tibet. However, those numbers are expected to rise significantly. US-based hiking company Himalayan Glacier has confirmed 15 Australians who were on one of its tours are missing, and Kathmandu also said the Kathmandu tours also said that one Australian was among the group that is missing from them.
But hundreds of Nepalese missing now.
Absolutely, yeah. It's going to be, the numbers will just continue to rise throughout the next few days, I'd imagine. The Department of Foreign Affairs has been sending, has dispatching teams to the area. Now, rescue authorities say that roads have been cut off on both sides of the border, which is making rescue attempts even more difficult. To other news, the US states that sued Meta over claims its platforms harm children have called a settlement with the social media giant a major moment. Meta has denied any wrongdoing, but it's agreed to make major changes to Facebook and Instagram and pay up to $25 billion in compensation. It says it will restrict teenagers' use of the platform to 2 hours a day, block all usage from midnight to 6 a.m. for the next decade, while also preventing children from accessing age-restricted content. Back home, Thredbo's Chamber of Commerce says local businesses are not surprised that the value of the Villages Alpine Resort has now been slashed in half. The resort's operator, EVT, has revealed the value of Thredbo dropped from $292 million to $143 million due to this year's poor snow season. Which, yeah, came to a pretty much as pretty
grinding
pretty
halt.
Much abrupt end. Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and tributes today for the English actor Tim Curry, star, of course, of the Rocky Horror Picture Show following his death at the age of 80. And fans have actually gathered outside the Broadway production of Rocky Horror, which is still ongoing.
Still going.
Yeah, after all these years.
God. Oh, they've had a few reboots, haven't they, I think, over the years.
Yeah, I think there's been a few cast changes.
Over the years. Yeah, yeah. Although he did do it on stage too, I think, for quite a while as well.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, and he was 80.
Yes.
But he had a stroke a long time ago, 15 years ago.
He had been a bit ill for quite a while.
Tim Curry.
I only ever saw the film. I never...
I saw the film. Yes,
remember
right.
They used to have those midnight screenings on George Street and everyone would dress up? Yeah.
I saw the midnight screenings in Adelaide.
You went there, didn't you?
When I was in high school,
Right. God.
It was a thing back then.
What a sight that would have been.
That's right, exactly.
All right.
We'll just
speak tomorrow.
We'll boggle the mind with the thoughts of that for the next 24 hours, and we'll talk tomorrow.
Okay.
Right. Thanks for that, Adam's story there with the news headlines. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details now. And Jordan Natara's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon, Michael.
Now, so all that rain has moved through now and the high-pressure system moved in?
Yeah, absolutely. We did see some storms yesterday afternoon. We've produced hail around parts of Dorigo, but that system has now moved well offshore. We are still seeing a couple of showers here or there, but relatively subtle conditions across the state today, and that's going to be a continual trend as we head across the weekend as well. That high-pressure system is going to be slow-moving, tracking across the state, but moving offshore by the time we head towards around Monday, Tuesday. The next system we're looking at the moment, starting to be modelled, is a frontal system that's going to brush the far south of state, and that's going to be somewhere between Tuesday and Thursday next week. It's going to bring a couple of showers still with it, but not necessarily high rainfall totals, and highest totals are going to be around parts of our alpine peaks. And as you already mentioned, with snow potential, it is not unfortunately going to bring any snow. It is pure rainfall with this system as well. And as it comes across, bringing some stronger westerly winds with it and warmer temperatures. So those temperatures even are expected to see even temperatures into the 30-degree range by Tuesday, Wednesday through our far northwestern inland, and those coastal zones are seeing those temperatures in the mid to high 20s. So starting to obviously hear the 1st of September and starting to see those warming trends start to be modelled within our forecast.
Yeah, so spring is upon us, and those temperatures at that level, mid-30s, we do see that in early spring sometimes, don't we? We've seen it in the last few years.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily the anomaly to say that we're going to see records being broken by this system, not at all. It's more to say that we are definitely starting to see those patterns shift already to those spring-like weather patterns, which, again, at this stage is looking as though that will bring some quite warm temperatures, gusty winds, and some relatively dry air with it as we see that system move through between Tuesday and Thursday.
And that the high-pressure system sounds like it's going to hang around for a number of days then.
Yeah, so short-term weather really driven by that high-pressure system. Benign conditions across the state with some frost in only a couple of spots, but really it's not necessarily. We're moving well out on these sort of winter weather patterns, and the temperatures are around 3 to 4 degrees, really above the average for this time of year for both maxes and mins. That high is going to sort of necessarily bring some relatively partly cloudy skies, but not necessarily any rainfall across the state, with a couple of showers maybe in some spots around parts of the northeastern coastlines. We head across the weekend, but again, totals are expected to be in the single digits for that system.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So that's still a few days away, though. Quite a few days away.
Yeah. So the short-term weather with that high, still seeing a couple of showers in that far north coast, but then that frontal system coming through later on, which is going to bring a bit more rainfall around the alpine peaks, but still, again, single digits for anywhere outside there.
Yeah, and looking at further ahead, any system rain systems coming across at all?
No, so post that cold front, we are still going to be seeing that next high pressure system building behind, which is a typical return for that sort of weather pattern. But again, at this moment, not anything clear in our weather modelling beyond that.
Right, okay. All right, we'll just keep an eye on that. Thanks for that, Jordan.
Catch you later.
It's coming up to 21 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Getting some texts on the carbon credit issue. Peter's texted in saying the interview on carbon credits, the take-home message is to increase cost of credit so much industry will lower their abatements. What will happen is that the increased cost will actually put the industry out of business. And he's suggesting a name change to the Country Hour there. But we gave a fair... fair assessment of the opposition to that call as well, Peter, so I think that's a bit unfair. Also, someone's texted in on the horses. Tony's texted in saying, I live on 100 acres of the floodplains of the Maclay River. The neighbour has foxes and they've contacted the local LES. There's nothing they can do about the foxes and they've just taken the chooks. Are they really concerned about feral animals, they're saying? And in regards to controlling of feral horses there and feral animals. But Grant's also texted in saying that the lady that was talking about the injunction there obviously doesn't own any horses. Grant says he does, and they do damage the ground. They compact the ground, they churn up the ground when it's wet, and he says they are not native to Australia. So he's got some sympathy with the arguments that in national parks, brumbies and feral horses do quite a lot of damage. There's quite a few other texts coming through as well. Colin says, I love horses, but they're when they're in a good place, but national parks are not the place for feral horses or feral species generally. National parks are supposed to be for native flora and flora. It's 19 minutes to one. Well, let's hear from a local palm scheme employer who says that the government isn't keeping up with the palm scheme workers who do a runner from the farms that they've agreed to work on. Under the scheme, workers are tied to an improved employer. If they leave that employer, they're not allowed to take on new work and so many become disengaged from the scheme, leaving them with few lawful options to keep working. John Ide is an approved palm scheme employer and director and owner of a company as well that says his workers have been breaking their agreements and leaving farms and the government are not keeping up with it. John was asked to explain how he's out of pocket if a palm scheme worker runs away from their delegated farm and their official employer.
When you apply to bring workers in from the Pacific Island through the palm scheme, there's several costs involved in that in obtaining those workers over here. Now, we got to upfront pay for their visa cost, their health insurance cost, their flights from their country to here, and then we recoup those costs after they start work over a certain period of time.
How do you recoup the costs?
We deduct it out of their wages.
What's your understanding of the workers' conditions on their visa when it comes to having to stay at a certain farm?
The palm scheme has its own Pacific visa. It's a 403 visa that has work limitations. These work limitations are a worker comes over here through an approved employer to work at a certain farm, what we call the host. Now, that is all put on paper before the worker even leaves their country. They do understand that who they're working for and the approved employer who's bringing them over here. When they get over here, some do go to multiple employers, but that's all got to be cleared by the Department of Employment. You cannot just bring a worker over here for a certain host and 2 weeks later take him somewhere else to another host. You can't do that. You've got to get permission from... It's all regulated through the palm scheme.
What has been your experience with palm scheme workers allegedly breaking their contract and leaving the farm for work at other farms?
It's a very sore point in my eyes for many reasons. Probably the biggest reasons is there's a lot of illegal workers over here that are not covered in their visa to be where they are, or their visa has run out completely. Until recently, I think I've only have had one person do a runner, but the situation is getting worse. And I've talked to other people within the industry, talk to the LSUs in the fellow countries, and it's very bad. It's put it this way, our government would not have a clue how many of these people are actually running around over here. And if they said they did, they're a liar.
You said until recently it hadn't been such an issue. Did anything change that may have made it more appealing to these workers to go somewhere that they weren't assigned to?
Yes. Number one, they're not getting chased no more. Number two, these visas used to be able to be cancelled by the approved employer. Now we got no hand in that. We go to what they call a portal from Home Affairs and we submit these details. And by what we've been told by a phone conversation by people from Home Affairs, someone's supposed to get in contact with us and discuss issues that could have forced these workers to leave. You know, like there are people out there that don't look after these people, you know, like, yes, but there's nothing happening. Our first worker has been gone for over 8 weeks. Now, we done a check on his visa last night and his visa is still valid. I'd just like to see a lot more done within this industry. I think it's a very good program, but it's lost its way.
That's John Ide, who's an approved Palm Scheme employer. Well, still on that issue, the Northern Rivers' largest employer of Palm Scheme workers is the Casino Food Co-op. They say ensuring all staff get equal pay and conditions is key to minimising problems with the scheme. The co-op currently employs around 300 Pacific Islanders under the scheme, making it about one-fifth of the total workforce that they have there. CEO Simon Stahl spoke with our reporter, Hannah Ross.
We employ them direct. We certainly use an agent to find the recruits in the company, but no, we employ them direct. We don't use labour hire. We started 3-4 years ago with a labour hire or an intermediate, but we found, look, it was better for us to manage the people ourselves and just make sure the people were a part of our team, so we elected to employ them directly.
Do you find that you have to contend with some of those issues of workers contracted to you, you know, seeking employment elsewhere or leaving when they're not really authorised to do so?
Yeah, certainly that happens, particularly in the early days. I think when it was quite a new scheme, we found a couple of people would come from, say, the islands, and then they might have relatives in state capitals and they were given some information about, they come down here and work with us. So there was a few that did disappear, I guess, and we left it with the authorities. But we haven't had that sort of instance for some time now, so we're pretty happy with our program.
Does the scheme operate well from your point of view?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, first and foremost, we've got about 1,500 people on the books now, so we are talking 300 of 1,500. First and foremost, the first person we employ is a resident Australian, and we're working really hard for skills training and retention. But the reality is, like Australia has for 100 years, we've had to get labour from overseas, and this Palm Scheme has really allowed us to get back up to capacity, and it's worked very well for us. I mean, the issuing of a visa is a government responsibility and a privilege, and employers can't be tasked with chasing people down if they've absconded, and certainly government should be chasing that down, or Home Affairs or whatever department's responsible. I think what it's doing for the people that come here is obviously giving them the employment opportunities that they don't have back home. And people might argue that it takes Australian jobs, but the reality is they're actually giving us an opportunity to employ more Australians. But without them, businesses would be struggling.
That's Simon Stahl there talking about the Casino Food Co-op. In a statement, the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations says it helps re-engage workers or facilitate an approved transfer to another Palm employer where appropriate. The government has also established an interdepartmental disengagement task force and a dedicated worker resolution and re-engagement team. We also reached out to the Minister for Industrial Relations and Workplace Health and Safety in New South Wales, Sophie Kotsis, and the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade for comment. It's coming up to 11 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today as the death toll in Nepal is rising fast after flash flooding and landslides with hundreds of locals and tourists missing. Hear from an Australian climate and environment academic stranded in Kathmandu and a prominent Nepalese-Australian businessman on support efforts underway here. Meanwhile, Meta is settling a landmark lawsuit agreeing to major changes to protect kids and teens. And they're back. Why the outcast royals, Harry and Meghan, have returned to the UK. Join me for The World Today.
Here on The Country Hour, kids in the bush that rely on specialist medical services can wait up to 6 years for access to a paediatrician. Without that medical help, certain conditions can spiral out of control and maybe even become a serious mental health issue. That's why the charity Little Wings is flying doctors out to the bush so kids can get the care and diagnosis that they need to access those appropriate treatments. Claire Pearson as CEO of Little Wings and says they provide the service mainly through volunteers, but they need some federal government help for the cost of maintaining the planes and also the fuel.
We know across regional and remote New South Wales there's a delay between 2 and 6 years, depending on the location in which the child resides, in terms of accessing any sort of paediatric specialist, but particularly a paediatrician to get that first diagnosis.
2 to 6 years?
Correct, yeah.
That's huge. That would never happen in the city.
Exactly. I mean, in the city, we complain if we've got to wait 6 months to see a specialist. But these are children that are waiting years and years, potentially, putting enormous pressure on families. And not only that, we're missing that critical window for development in many cases, where early intervention has the biggest impact. So it's just not good enough, really.
And what sort of implications are there for these kids? What are we seeing as a result of not having access to those specialists?
Well, I think most children get referred to a paediatrician, you know, around that 2-year age group. So if they're waiting 6 years, they're well into education, which means they're not absorbing all that information as best they could because their neurological functions aren't there. It means there's enormous pressure on the family, and it also means that with escalating behaviours potentially, families are showing up in desperation at emergency departments, blocking beds and taking up services they need not if they just had that first diagnosis and early intervention on a regular and routine basis.
So without early intervention, it ends up being potentially a mental health issue.
That's right. It has lifelong implications. We know this. The research is there in every aspect. Kids need early intervention in order for their brain synapses to have the full function and for them to reach their full potential. And the earlier, the better. We know the first 2,000 days of development are the most critical for brain development.
And I guess the other thing is that quite often you'll hear about kids or young adolescents self-medicating to help them to cope with everyday life.
That's right. We have seen and had many requests from high schools where children 13 plus have not been diagnosed throughout their primary years, and they've essentially aged out of services. And so high schools and principals have been contacting us in desperation to fly these paediatricians out to diagnose and to medicate or refer or integrate early intervention so that children can start to engage in appropriate behaviours in the classroom, socially, in community. But without that, yes, that we are seeing antisocial behaviours, self-medicating with drugs and alcohol.
Are we seeing with this with farm kids, Indigenous kids in the bush? What sort of demographic are we talking about?
You know, it's any and every child. We do see a high percentage of Indigenous children, of course, but it's every child, you know. Disability, neurological needs, healthcare issues, they don't discriminate. It's any child who needs this access, that's who we're supporting.
So it could be kids with autism, they don't get diagnosed, there's a long lag time, the conditions get worse, their behaviour deteriorates, and it could all be nipped in the bud with some intervention or, you know, maybe drugs or, you know, specialised counselling.
That's exactly right. And without that diagnosis, families can't unlock, you know, NDIS funding or other services because they don't have that piece of paper that says this is what my child has and this is what my child needs.
So what are you calling for? What would you like to see?
We would love to see ongoing funding through the federal government, of course. We would love to see paediatricians joining us in delivering additional services into these regions. Some of these communities we're flying into with a paediatrician, they have waiting lists of over 400 children. Like, These are major issues. There's a major backlog that's just not getting to the children that need it the most, and we need people to come on board and support us in delivering what we're doing. For whatever reason, doctors are not moving out to the regions. So for Little Wings to pick them up and get them home in time for dinner means that regional kids are still getting the care they need, but it also means that these paediatricians can maintain a work-life balance and continue to serve those in the city that they're committed to.
But I guess you can't do it for free.
We can't do it for free. We are 90% volunteer-led. All our pilots, all our drivers, they volunteer their time, but we have to fuel the planes. And without the planes, we can't get there in a timely manner.
And what sort of response have you had from the federal government?
The federal government have supported us for the last 5 years, but we haven't seen a renewal of that contract. So we're really hoping that they open up those conversations and continue to support us, because without them, we really can't continue.
Claire Pearson is the CEO of Little Wings. Let's go to markets. Let's go to Wagga Sheep and Lambs first up.
Good afternoon. Wet weather meant 5,400 less lambs, with 26,100 offered and 7,570 sheep. The limited numbers in all classes, particularly heavy export lambs, saw buying intensify and as processors tried to secure numbers. Prices jumped $15 to $25 and more, regaining most of last week's losses. New season's trade lambs, $244 to $316, $24 to $26, $299 to $323, $26 to $30, $312 to $354, to average $1,131 a kilogram carcass weight. Old trade lambs, $240 to $300, $24 to $26 kilo, $288 to $328, $26 to $30. And momentum built, 301 to 365, over 30 kilos, 360 to 454. Merino trades, 218 to 277. Heavy merinos, 296 to 335. Young lambs back to the paddock, 180 to 238. Hoggets the better end, 258 to 330. Heavy sheep sold $20 to $30 steerer. Heavy ewes, 230 to 335. Ewes back to the paddock to 334. And trade sheep, 190 to 228. I'm Leanne Dax, MLA.
Let's go to Dubbo Cattle now.
Good afternoon. Numbers are back to 1,299 mixed quality cattle. There are a few weaners. Good numbers of light feeders, medium and heavyweight feeders were limited to a few good drafts. The grown steers and heifers were in short supply, and the cow run was planted with fewer prime heavyweights. The market sold to stronger trends. Weaner steers were up to 25 cents stronger, selling to 624 cents. The heifers jumped 40 to 50 and ranged from 445 to 534. Feeder steers were 30 cents stronger, 520 to 581. The heifers lifted 12 to 15, the secondary heifers having some of the bigger gains, 496 to 540. Trade cattle were 20 cents better, 491 to 555. The prime grown steers and bullocks, 475 to 492. And heavy grown heifers, 440 to 488, were lifted 10 cents. The cows were 15 to 20 cents stronger. The secondary cows the strongest. Heavyweights, 405 to 425. The leaner two score cows, 364 to 382.
Let's go now to Yass cattle.
Numbers fell this summer with agents yarding just 380 head. Quality was very mixed, with yearlings making up the majority of the offering. Grown cattle were limited and the usual bars were present competing. Middle and heavyweight yearling steers to feed sold from 485 to 570 cents, with lightweights back to the paddock reaching 600. The few trade steers topped at 510. Heifers to feed sold from 380 to 520 cents, with those to the trade reaching 440. The few better grown heifers sold from 375 to 430 cents, and cows were very limited in number and received from 340 to 426 cents. The best bull reached 432. This has been Crystal Ridley at SELX Cattle for MLA.
Let's go to Armidale now.
Some widespread general rain helped contribute to just 274 cattle scanned in Armidale this week, less than half on a fortnight ago. Most major buyers were present for an overall dearer market, with increased restocker competition on most categories, with a large percentage of the yarding presenting in store condition. Yearling steers to feed were 30 cents dearer to make from 530 to 600 cents. Yearling heifers to feed were also 30 cents dearer to make from 436 to 550 cents kilogram. Light steers to the restocker lacked quality and made from 400 to 545 cents kilogram, while the light heifers were considerably dearer to make from 480 to 542 cents. Prime grown cattle to the processor made from 390 to 412 cents. With the help from restockers, cows were 25 to 30 cents dearer across the board. Two score cows made from 320 to 370 cents. Three score cows made from 372 to 381 cents. Prime heavyweight cows made from 388 to 397 cents kilogram. Cows going back to the paddock made from 355 to 370. And the best of the bulls got to 420 cents kilo. This is Hamish Osgood in Armidale for MLA.
You're listening to the Country Hour. The final word goes to someone who's texted in saying that if we're capable of culling Brumbies, then why don't we do the same with the feral pigs, etc.? I had just one feral pig on the property, and the damage that that one pig caused was immense, and that came from a national park forest. So the era of culling of Brumbies, why can't we see more of that, of the feral pigs? You're listening to the Country Hour. We're heading up to news time.